Hey everyone, and welcome back to your Linux and open source news show. I'm your host, Nick, and this is a podcast where we discuss everything that happened in the Linux, open source, privacy, and open web spaces. And this week, we've got Intel trying to reinvent modular PCs, billing this as an innovation in terms of computer design. We also have the release of the Linux kernel 6.13. We've got Deepin 25 looking like it's going to be a big departure from the current Deepin distribution. We've got some interesting results from the Arch Linux survey. We've got game developers starting to take Linux into account. We've got the release of Wine 10 and a lot more. So as always, if you need to dive deeper into any of these topics, all the links that I used are in the show notes. And if you want to support the show, I left a bunch of links in the show notes as well, including one to our sponsor, Tuxedo Computers. You probably know about them by now if you've been listening to this show for a while. They make desktops and laptops that ship with Linux out of the box. All the components are picked specifically for their Linux compatibility. They actively contribute drivers to Linux to make sure that everything runs, and they have a big, big range of computers that should fit every price point and every need. So if you need a new computer, just do like I did and just buy stuff from Tuxedo. I don't use stuff from any other manufacturer these days. I just run everything from one of their laptops and I game on one of their desktops. The link, as always, is in the description. Okay, so in a funny corporate is completely out of touch moment, Intel is now advocating for what they call an innovative approach in how they will design PCs. And this innovative approach is, get this, making computers modular. You can imagine a world where you would swap the components of computers freely so as to reduce e-waste and extend the life cycle of devices. It's completely insane, I know, but it is what Intel is pushing through three Intel executives who wrote a blog post about this. Sarcasm aside, it's good to see a big company push for this. Like, right to repair is absolutely crucial. Everything being soldered inside of laptops is a trend that needs to go away. So if Intel can do more than just write about it, but instead uses their considerable resources and influence to make that modularity and repairability the norm, this would be great. Now, of course, this is Intel, so there is very likely a big commercial angle. They created three standards or platforms. They're pitching first premium modular PCs. This is high-end laptops where you could replace three boards inside, the core motherboard and the universal left and right I/O boards. These would be universal for all premium modular PCs, meaning you could get the board from one and swap it with the other. They presumably would have the exact same I/O. They also would have the entry modular PCs, which would also function on three different boards that you could replace, but with multiple SKUs, not just one single I/O board design, so manufacturers could create various boards that suit the components and the PC they're trying to sell for, well, the entry-level market. And finally, they're pushing the desktop modular PC, which is a regular desktop PC where you can change components inside. Except they would add slide rails to every case design, so it would be easier to install and remove components. Intel would also like to introduce modules that are based on a Type-C connector or an M.2 board, so you could technically do what Framework does for their I/O with little modules you can plug in, but this would be for various modules inside the computer, like for example the Wi-Fi chip or the Bluetooth chip. Now this, on paper, all sounds great, but it also sounds like this is going to be a plan where you have to pay royalties and fees to Intel to actually be able to build these kinds of modular PCs. I'm not sure if Intel will give that as an open source design initiative and let people use it, or if they're gonna charge manufacturers and hardware vendors to rely on this platform. And this would also mean that no computer shipping AMD hardware would be able to follow these guidelines. We're gonna have to see. Hopefully it's done in the open. It is an open platform that anyone can build upon, and that would be cool. But it's also really funny to see Intel trying to return or reinvent a commercial name for what should be the default, as in you swap out a component and you put a new one in instead of soldering everything. Now, the Linux kernel 6.13 is now available, provided your distro gives you kernel updates. Among the features are what they call lazy preemption, which is how the kernel decides which tasks it's going to run first, even if others have started before it. Lazy preemption simply adds a new flag to that system that lets a task say, I would like to be preempted, as in, I would like to take priority, but not necessarily immediately. The task could be preempted by the kernel and take priority, but it doesn't force the kernel to give it priority right now. And this should result in better performance overall. Shared memory ring size can now also be dynamically resized, meaning the kernel can have smaller ring sizes that block less memory as they start the computer, and then it could expand those rings as needed so things are better optimized. The work queue is now expanded to 2048 tasks instead of 512 concurrent processes, a change that will likely only affect really high-end workstations and servers that run a lot of stuff at the same time. What is really nice as well is support for iPhone and iPad chips from the A7 to the A11. But don't get too excited, it doesn't mean you're going to be able to run a full-blown Linux distro on your old iPad anytime soon. This really is only support for the basic ARM CPU, not even the entire SoC, and not the rest of the hardware inside. X4 and XFS also gained atomic write support, meaning writing things to the disk is now protected. Either the data is fully written to disk or it's not written at all, meaning if your computer crashes or turns off, you don't have corrupted files that are half written and half the old data that wasn't overwritten yet. And as always, you can look forward to a bunch of driver updates, optimizations to various subsystems like SE Linux and a bunch of other things. These changelogs are usually pretty huge. You will get that update or not at all, depending on the distro you run and their policy on updating kernels. Now, Deepin is not a distribution I would ever recommend to anyone, but it still exists, and they do have plans. Deepin 25 is their next iteration, and it is a big departure from the current model that they have. First, they've announced something called Solid. This is a framework to create basically what is an immutable system. It can set system directories as read-only, it can protect the update process using atomic updates, so you only write updates if they are complete and you don't have updates that half succeed and half fail and leave your system broken. The system will also boot from a system image that is updated, not from an in-place updated system like most traditional distros. There is, of course, the usual rollback feature and snapshot feature to return to a previous system image if something goes wrong. Now, on top of becoming an immutable distro, Deepin will also overhaul their desktop. They have a new control center and notification center in Deepin 25. They have a notification to encourage users to provide translations for the desktop, which is definitely needed because Deepin has this charming sort of auto-translated Chinese to English feel, which has some really strange turns of phrases that are really funny, but also kind of cool. Region-dependent office suites being pre-installed is now a thing as well, so meaning depending on where you live, you won't get the same office suite pre-installed. You'll get WPS in China, but presumably something else outside of China. You'll get more coherent UI components across the desktop, window effects, translucency, customizable title bar height for non-Deepin apps, so you can integrate those better into the desktop, and more. They also now have a Wayland session using their Treeland compositor. And they're even pushing further on AI. They don't seem to be fixing the major issue, which is you have to already have a default AI provider and an API key to plug into the system. But if you do have that, then not only will you get the usual assistance that Deepin introduced previously, but you'll also get AI search across images and documents, and you'll get a little AI taskbar icon where you can drag any file onto it, and you'll get some options like summarizing the document, translating it, proofreading it. But yeah, you'll still need like an OpenAI API key or any other API key you need to use. It doesn't run locally with a local model. Now, this will not make me use Deepin as my own system. It still doesn't fit my needs, and I'm not really a big fan of the Deepin desktop. But this is an interesting change of pace, and it is going to solve a bunch of issues that I personally had with Deepin, so it's interesting. Now, this is something I missed last week, but Arch Linux conducted a community survey, which gathered 3.9 thousand answers, which is not too bad, and it gives some interesting indications on what Arch users actually use. Interestingly, desktop environments still represent the vast majority of what people use. Even though tiling managers are about 37-38% of the graphical environments Arch users use, with Hyperland holding 26% of all this graphical environment market share, Plasma represents 36.8% on its own, GNOME is an extra 10.8%, and then you have the smaller ones like XFCE at 3.4, Cinnamon as 1.6. So graphical desktop environments are still prevalent and are still more used than tiling window managers, even on Arch. Web browsers, unsurprisingly, seem to be mostly Firefox with 57.9%, but Chrome still holds 17% and Brave 10% of that market share. Arch is mostly used on desktops, 57.8% compared to laptops, and people seem to prefer using graphical tools to the command line. 65% of people said that if there was a graphical tool available, they would prefer that to using the command line. Overwhelmingly, Wayland is also preferred. 79.6% of respondents said they prefer using Wayland, which really challenges what I thought. I was certain there were far more people still on the X11 train. 40% of Arch users seem to use NVIDIA GPUs, with 31% using an AMD dedicated GPU. If we combine both AMD integrated and dedicated, though, it's more than NVIDIA with about 2% more. Arch users seem to be fine with the command line install from Arch. About 50% of users just relied on that to install Arch, but 32% used the Arch install script to get the thing on their hard drive. As per the Arch experience, 55% of respondents said it was fairly easy, meaning it wasn't really difficult. They had some issues, but they could fix them quite easily. 10.7% said it's just completely easy, so no trouble. And 29% think it's a moderately difficult experience, as in they are encountering issues from time to time, but they manage to fix them after a little search. The remaining 5% found the experience difficult. Overwhelmingly, Arch is not people's first distro. 87% of people used something else first, and the reasons that would prevent people from using Arch, this was only answered by people not running Arch, include too much configuration to get a system running, some stability problems, and the install process being too convoluted. 30% of the people who answered this question said they also were just happier on another distro, but that's just 116 people out of the almost 4,000 who answered that survey. Now, it's interesting stuff. It's only about 4,000 answers, which is not huge, but it's still statistically significant, and it really challenges a bunch of ideas I had about Arch. I really thought Arch was the land of the tiling manager, the land of the X11 diehards, and the land of the pure open source AMD GPUs, but it's the complete opposite, so it's, yeah, kind of funny. Now, if you needed one more reason to distrust benchmarks as an industry, well, here's another one. An AI benchmarking organization apparently failed to disclose the fact that they had ties to OpenAI, as in they received funding from OpenAI because this company used this Frontier Math benchmark to demo their new O3 AI model. Supposedly, this is going to be much better than everything OpenAI showed since then. The problem is, this Frontier Math benchmark was funded by OpenAI, and no one was made aware of that fact before they disclosed their results. OpenAI apparently also had privileged access to the various problems and solutions that the benchmark posed to their AI, meaning they could potentially train on all of these problems and make sure that their AI could solve that benchmark much better than others. Mathematicians who contributed to that benchmark also did not know that this relationship existed, and they did not know that OpenAI could have exclusive access to the benchmark when other companies couldn't. OpenAI apparently only had a verbal agreement with the nonprofit developing the benchmark, saying that, oh yeah, no, we're not gonna use your benchmark to train our AI on, we're gonna run it fairly, meaning basically they absolutely train their AI, because OpenAI doesn't respect any written license or copyright attribution. They're not gonna respect a verbal agreement. Apparently, the nonprofit behind the benchmark also was not able to independently verify OpenAI's result on that benchmark. They could not see if OpenAI's O3 model managed to actually get the score that they said it did, and they also couldn't see how it reached these conclusions, which seems to reinforce the fact that OpenAI definitely trained their AI on this specific benchmark to get better results than other companies, so they could raise more funding by making it look like their model is better at math. It's just still a nightmare show, this whole AI thing. If at some point they want to be treated like regular, legitimate businesses, they're gonna have to start acting like anything other than pure clowns. Now this week we saw the release of Wine 10. It's the new stable version of the Windows compatibility layer. It embarks more than 6,000 changes, and it's a big, big release, the culmination of a full year of work. It's also going to serve as the base for a future Proton version, and generally just the base for Linux gaming in general. So first in here is ARM support. Wine can now integrate with emulators to run x86 Windows programs on Linux, but on an ARM platform. They don't provide an emulator directly, but they basically have all the hooks so you can plug any emulator into it. For example, something like FEX could be used to fill in that gap. Wine also improved how it can run ARM binaries for Windows, but on Linux for ARM. Wine 10 also adds high DPI support, or at least it fleshes it out, meaning that the windows that aren't DPI aware, as in they would not be able to scale themselves according to the scaling factor of your Linux desktop, well, these apps can now be scaled automatically. This can lead to blurriness, though, so it can be disabled by users in the Wine settings on a per app or per prefix basis. Vulkan can now also be used to render child windows instead of OpenGL, but this is still just for X11, not for Wayland. Because yes, Wine now has its native Wayland driver that supports OpenGL. This is enabled by default if you're running just Wayland, but if both Wayland and X11 would be available, meaning you have X-Wayland installed, then it will still default to the X11 backend. Presumably because right now it only supports OpenGL and not Vulkan, and so the performance is probably not as good. Wine 10 comes with a new desktop control panel applet that lets you configure the display for Wine programs. It lets you change the resolution of a virtual desktop if you're running your apps in one instead of running them as native Linux windows. Touchscreens are also now supported on X11 with multi-touch. There's a new joystick control panel applet as well if you have one of these devices. And Wine can also fake display resolution changes. Instead of actually changing the resolution of your display, this can help some games, and it can also avoid messing up your system configuration. This feature is opt-in for now and experimental. You can also try out a new FFmpeg-based backend to replace the GStreamer-based one, and the Media Foundation, the thing used to play audio or video inside of games and apps, is now better implemented and should work better across all games. There's also now Direct Play support, this being an older DirectX API that lets, well, older games play online, or let the players of these older games play online together. Now this is a huge release, and congrats to the team for all the work they put in. Wine is the backbone of Linux gaming. I don't personally use it at all to play any Windows programs other than games, but it's a huge endeavor. I'm really disappointed though that the native Wayland driver in here is not fully featured yet, meaning that we're gonna have to wait another full year for Wine 11 until Proton can have that fully complete Wayland driver, assuming this thing is also finally completed for next year, which there's no guarantee of that either. Still, good work on the Wine team. It's gonna provide a lot of new features and performance for Linux gaming, so that's great. Now, Canonical and Ubuntu seem really committed to Flutter, the toolkit or framework that they chose to build their own applications for Ubuntu. Even though Google significantly scaled back their investments on the desktop side of Flutter, they mostly invest on making it a better platform for mobile applications, Canonical apparently kept working at that specific side of Flutter, meaning they want to improve it for desktop apps, which makes sense because that's what they use Flutter for themselves. So their next project around that support is going to be multiple windows for Flutter desktop apps. Currently, you can only spawn one window from a Flutter application. You can spawn pop-ups, but they darken the entire thing and they don't look like native pop-ups in a Linux desktop. Obviously, this is a problem for many types of applications. You need in certain apps to have multiple windows. So the approach they've chosen apparently is completely seamless for Flutter developers. You can just use the current widgets that you know inside of Flutter, and they will automatically work with multi-window support if it's available on the system. Now, what's interesting is that this support that Canonical developed only works on Windows right now and will arrive on macOS and Linux soon after, which I have to wonder why, because Ubuntu only makes Linux apps. So why would they develop something on Windows first and then port it to Linux? I don't really know. It's interesting to see Ubuntu sticking with Flutter. I was really expecting them to scale back on this after Google basically said, we don't care about Flutter on the desktop, you can handle that yourself. But no, Ubuntu built their App Center with it, they built their installer with it, they built their security center with it and all the Snap permission system. It's not the ecosystem I prefer on Linux, all this Snap stuff and Ubuntu specific stuff, but I can't say it's bad, it's really not. Now, it looks like AMD is doubling down on Linux support with a new project called AMD GPU Composition Stack, or ACS. What that is a fork of Weston, a reference Wayland compositor, which adds additional advanced features to the entire stack. The goal of this project is to be a staging area for Wayland features and their reference implementation in Weston. It also is meant to act as a reference compositor for AMD's specific graphics feature. And so, they want to make something that works best with AMD GPUs. They said they are not afraid to have pure bias with AMD GPUs, meaning it's gonna work way better with an AMD GPU, but probably way worse with NVIDIA and Intel, and they're not worried about that. That's kind of the goal. And this is why they have to fork Weston, because some of their AMD-specific code would not be accepted in that project. Weston is meant to be a reference implementation that is hardware vendor agnostic, so changes that would only benefit AMD and potentially degrade performance on others would likely not be accepted. AMD also said something interesting. They said they want to use this compositor in their commercial solutions and products, which seems to indicate AMD wants to start providing Linux-based solutions of some sort. Or maybe they're gonna start distributing their drivers plus that compositor and all their various libraries, APIs, frameworks, and toolkits, and SDKs. This compositor already supports variable refresh rate, FreeSync, color management, HDR with full screen videos, media playback with their own media player, and more. Now, we'll have to see where it goes and if this compositor actually provides better performance on AMD hardware, but I could already see this thing, if it's fully open source, being baked into certain distros. For example, anything built with uBlue could build specific ISOs designed for AMD that pack this compositor instead of anything else, so you can run your games, well, potentially with better performance. We'll have to see where it goes, but it's an interesting project, and it really shows AMD's commitment to Linux, to Wayland, and to probably open source, so that's pretty cool. And we're going to conclude with some gaming stuff. It looks like interest is growing around Linux as a platform for gaming, because in a recent survey at the Games Developer Conference, 3,000 developers were asked which platforms they were targeting with their games, and Linux was cited by 12% of people. This is much lower than Mac, which gathered 23% of answers, meaning 23% of developers who answered this survey said that they're working on a Mac version for their current game that they're working on, compared to only 12% of them making a Linux version. Now, PC, meaning Windows here, is cited by 80% of developers as a platform that they're targeting, which apparently is a lot more than previous years. The Steam Deck was not a platform mentioned in the survey, they only had Linux, but out of all the people who said other in their answers, 44% of them said that they were working on making a game that runs on the Steam Deck. Now, of course, 12% of developers really does not mean much. It could just be indie developers, meaning big titles, still aren't targeting Linux for better or worse, depending on which games you like to play. As per the Windows games, well, most of them will just run on Linux without any problem. So developers don't necessarily feel the need to target Linux specifically. If you build your game for Windows, it's really going to run on Linux unless there's a specific anti-cheat solution involved. And 12% declaring for Linux is more than PlayStation Plus, and it's very close to Xbox Game Pass, which has 13% of developers saying that their next project targets this specific platform. It's also more than the Switch 2, but this is not even out, so I don't think it counts. Now, every time I talk about Linux gaming, I know it feels or looks or sounds like I'm huffing copious amounts of copium, but honestly, I don't think we've been in a better position than right now with Linux gaming. It's not perfect, it's probably never going to be, the anti-cheat stuff is still really annoying, but apart from that, everything runs really, really well on Linux and potentially on the Steam Deck. So it's cool to see more interest towards Linux, even though it's not like 80% of people saying they're gonna do a game for the Steam Deck. Still not bad. Okay, so this will conclude this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, all the links that I used are in the show notes. You can click on them and go read the full articles. All the links that let you support the show, because I kind of need your help to keep this going, they're also in the show notes. And if you want to check out our sponsor, Tuxedo Computers, the link is also in there. Thank you all for listening, and I guess you'll hear me in the next one next week. Bye!